I'd like to welcome Anne-Marie Oman to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Anne-Marie.
Hi, how are you?
Anne-Marie, over the last 10 years, you perhaps are one of the most frequent guests.
Am I? Oh, that's what an honor. I didn't know that. Thank you.
And today we're celebrating of sorts.
A retirement of sorts.
A retirement of sorts. 17 years at the Interlochen Arts Academy, most of the time directing the writing program. That followed 20 years in public schools?
Public schools and various private schools. I have left no stone unturned in the educational field.
And now we're going, heading towards this retirement, but you're going to continue on as a college instructor, a graduate instructor.
Right. I'll continue my work working for the Solstice MFA at Pine Manor College, which is a low residency program. And that means I get to go to Boston for a couple of weeks twice a year, and then the rest of it is online, which is a magnificent way if you're going to do retirement of sorts.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. You will continue to be in the area.
Right.
How did you get started in this writing business? This has been such a big part of your life.
Oh, it has been. But I think, you know, you and I have talked about this story before, that I was a resistant or a troubled reader when I started way, way, way back as a child. But once I discovered the power of words, I really always was a scribbler, always played with diaries and journals and all the things that kids do. And but didn't become serious until late. I'm a late bloomer that way, too, in that I was in my 30s after my first marriage ended and was asking myself those important questions. What do I want to do? What is really meaningful? And what kept coming back was that I loved writing. And so I began like almost everybody begins if you don't do this in college. I started taking individual courses, working with mentors, reading as much as I could in the fields that I was interested in, going to conferences, and just slowly building knowledge and experience that way.
And you also were very active in community theater.
Yes, yes. And community theater actually was a huge influence on my sense of dialogue and voice. That came, I think, relatively quickly to me. One thing that came quickly, because when you're in the theater, you're surrounded by voices and multiple rhythms, and the idea of breath as rhythm, all of those things are embedded in the study of theater. So that part was great background for me.
And your early writing, much of that was poetry.
Yes, I thought I was a poet to begin with. And I think those impulses are always there, the tendency toward lyricism and the metaphorical description. Those things have stayed with me. And poetry, I don't think it will ever hurt the study of poetry for a prose writer.
Mm-hmm.
Even though most of my work in the last decade or so has been prose-based, the lessons that I take from poetry about language are, they're the bedrock.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
A few years ago, you started writing memoir. I shouldn't say a few years ago. What was it, 10 years ago or so?
Well, actually, it started in almost 20, maybe 25 years ago when I began to seek, early in that time when I was making a change toward writing, I began to seek publication. And our magazine, Traverse Magazine, they were looking for those short, really tight columns, 800 to 1,000 words. And those were the first pieces of prose that were published. And boy, they taught me a lot when I think about it now, that working in that shorter form and having to make a tight little narrative and an insightful moment, that was the beginning of memoir for me, because I the first thing I did was to mine my own life for material. And that's the early form that took. And some of that became part of my master's thesis. Some of those pieces expanded, shifted, of course. And then much of that, if you read the first book, Pulling Down the Barn, there are at least a dozen chapters that started as Traverse Magazine columns. So if you can believe that. So I owe them a lot. Yeah.
Now, your approach to memoir, I think, is absolutely brilliant. And
oh,
I have recommended your books to so many people who approach me and say, I want to write the story of my life. And I say, before you do that, would you please do one thing for me? Read Anne Marie's books, Pulling Down the Barn, House of Fields.
Oh, thank you.
Could you talk about that for a few minutes? Because most people try to do too much. They don't have a focus or a target. And what I've noticed about your work is it's so clearly focused, and you really create a narrative arc in each piece of memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Something happens.
And I think that's important to think about. When we're asking somebody to read our work, especially when we're asking them to read something about our lives, we are asking them to give us their most precious commodity, which is their time. And so we better make it worth their while in some way to put that time toward us. So the idea is that in every transformative moment, there is action. So what I think about is not how do I tell the story of my life from beginning to end, but what are the most important moments? What are the transformative moments, the moments in which actually something important shifted one way or another? And it can be loud and noisy, like your first car accident. You know, everybody's got a story about that. Or it can be something as quiet as the first time you realize that you are alone and that you're a separate being. It can be that quiet and intimate. And but whatever it is, the idea of zeroing in on that moment, creating that as a center, and then writing toward and away from it. So you automatically begin to work in an arc. And I don't think that's really new material, but I think many people think they have to say everything, when really what we want to hear is, wow, what changed you? What? And then, of course, there's the whole process of putting those that series together thematically. And that's maybe another lesson.
But when you've taught memoir, you start out by having people find the three or four or five special moments in their
life. Exactly. And we talk about making a life list and working from a life list so that you don't have to start at the beginning. You can start anywhere. Once you've got this life list shaped, then you can start anywhere. You can work in the middle, you can work at the beginning, you can work at the end, but you work in these smaller units, and you don't try to say anything about being potty trained or your kindergarten teacher, unless that's a transformative moment.
And some of your transformative moments are absolutely amazing, like insisting that you get to drive the family tractor only to run into your father's new pickup truck.
Oh, please. Did you have to bring that one up? That's right. And that was an important moment for me because I had been in that process of understanding that I was probably not going to follow the agricultural expectation for a woman of that time, for the farm culture. And as a result, that confirmed that I would need to leave the farm in some way and began the journey.
So if we can go to one of those memoirs now.
Sure.
You are, I believe, in third grade and you are struggling with reading.
Oh, yes. Okay. That's in the memoir House of Fields, which is Memories of a Rural Education. And I did struggle with reading. It was a really difficult time in my little third grade cosmos. And I didn't think I'd ever learn to read. And then, as we know now, reading is developmental, and it came together for me in one rainy day when I'm being harassed by other little girls and I've isolated myself, and I pick up a little book. Many of our readers or your listeners will remember Honey Bunch and Norman's series, and then it comes together. And it's a small miracle. And the title of the chapter is Miracle. And this is that moment. Oh, and there's one allusion here to the Dick and Jane books, the Basil series that many people will also remember
them well.
So here's that moment. I sit in the small alcove for all of lunch, running my fingertips over the lines, mouthing the words that are coming now to the surface like fish. I study a word and the words around it until they move toward me like shards of metal drawn to the small magnet in science class. Once they are there, They do not let go. I move through the pages from one simple adventure to the next. I understand this story the way I have understood when listening to fairy tales. Something is happening, taking shape. No one in a perfectly clean dress is standing on a perfectly clean sidewalk saying, "Look, look." They are doing something that I want to know about, something that I want the way I want my father to laugh. The word plot is years away, but if you had asked, I would have said simply, I need to know what happens. What happens to them? What happens to me is that the pieces come together in a few hours. They come together during the lunch and afternoon recesses and the bus ride home, where for the first time I don't care that no one wants to talk to me because Honeybunch has just been found by a strange boy in the woods. I don't care because suddenly words are there, and this is something I can't say, only feel as I read. I can at last forget them. I am too young to know what a miracle is, except for the biblical versions that have been read to me, full of fire and floods. I don't know that a miracle setting might be as ordinary and plain as a small alcove of books, as simple as wilting marigolds blooming after all. The mind hits an invisible window which, instead of the thud and drop of the bird, breaks open. All the pieces fly apart and then come back together into an order so that a child can move through shards of language, watching them come into their places. A body dizzy with something intoxicating, moving through, tumbling, rolling, can rise safe and walk, dumb with luck. What seems becomes real, fire, flood, right then.
Wow.
Thank you.
And it works out.
It does.
The next year you were reading The Brothers Karamazov.
I did move pretty quickly, but not quite to that.
So most writers have day jobs.
Right.
Some of those day jobs enrich them as writers because it gives them more life experience. Mm-hmm. Other day jobs, not so much. How about teaching? How has teaching influenced you as a writer?
Wow, good question. Especially when you're teaching writing, and because I went into the teaching of English first and then composition, mm-hmm. and then finally the creative writing world, when you're a writer and a teacher, you have two muses or two masters, and those metaphors, muse and master, depict, I think, the tension that you live with all the time, because to some degree teaching and writing draw on the same creative elements, and you have to be on and ready for both of them. So I think it's difficult to and challenging and also beautiful to work with those two muses. Teaching for the last, several decades, especially at Interlaken, has been both joyous and very demanding. And I have truly loved working there, but I've also felt that some days it was a balance between my writing and that muse and the teaching muse. And other days, because of the nature of teaching, it felt like the artistic muse wasn't getting proper attention. So those two things have I think are just part of the life of a teaching artist, whether it's writing or painting or whatever. The teaching artist will always have to try to balance that and hope that the tension does balance. In the case of Interlaken, because of Interlaken, I have been in the context of so many other artists and writers. Mm-hmm. And for all the demands, that adventure of being among other people who are of like minds, who are also thinking about art, not just teaching art, but how to make art and use that art as a model for students, and that whole collaborative element is a cradle. Mm-hmm. And I use that word like Whitman uses it, out of the cradle endlessly rocking. It's a way you can find your voice by simply being among other people who are also working. And so that's been rich.
It's very special, isn't it? A community of not only teachers, but of artists, working artists.
Right. Who have to work that same, those same two muses. They have to answer to both the beautiful teaching experience and the making experience. So at Interlaken, because of Interlaken, I have been in that context. And at the same time that I was often short of time, almost always short of time, I was also making work because I was inspired by the people around me.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention your work as a playwright.
Oh, thank you. As a matter of fact, during my time at Interlaken, I was able to complete four full-length pieces. So, and most of them are history-based. Mm-hmm. So at the same time I was working, I was also trying to live in my place, in this place that's also wonderfully rich for history. So that's a gift. It's pretty wonderful. Yeah.
So now you're looking towards the future. There is another book that is going to be coming out in the near future.
I'm really excited.
It's got a great title.
Yes, the title, this is another memoir. It is called Love, Sex, and 4-H. And I was in 4-H for 10 years from, I'm going to betray my age here, 1959 to 1969. And 4-H was the sort of public, it was my way into the public world. And it was extremely important to me for all of that structure that it gave me for what was happening in the 60s. Mm-hmm. So again, this pleasurable tension between the kind of terrifying time we lived in the 60s and then this very stable, conventional, loyal organization.
And growing up on a farm.
Oh, yes.
Just south of us, what, 60 miles near Hart?
Exactly, yes, near Hart. Yeah, a little village called Crystal Valley.
So how does that book begin?
Oh, well, I can share it with you.
I should tell listeners that Anne-Marie is reading this off the screen of her computer.
Well,
it shows you where you are in the whole process.
Yes, that the print copies are still being burned. So this is the prologue to Love, Sex, and 4-H. Our family, that straightforward, plain-spoken, clean-faced, for the most part, farm family, lives at the cusp of free love, on the eve of great change, the brink of national upheaval. We have no idea. I have no idea. We live near a small American town in the heart of the Great Lakes, a town named Hart, the pun delights me, near the coast of Lake Michigan, one of the great inland seas, in a rural Michigan that has yet to feel anything more than the slightest tremors of turmoil, though we might have seen the cracks and quaverings in our cities, Detroit, Milwaukee, if we had not been so insular. There is trouble, of course, as there always is in small communities, but that trouble is in other families, separate enough from the Omen's acreage that we feel our safety as the norm. Yet even in our isolation, change slips to the surface. Assassinations, demonstrations turned to riots, a war that will scar us for half a century. The deaths that became legendary are the edges of my experience. John, Martin, Robert, and even Janice, Jimmy, Morrison, those critical peripheries. The famed names and their narratives are common parlance even now, and many persons have claimed a part undeservedly, but I was not part of it. Even so, because the 60s were so big, those years became the all-important and formative backdrop of my life. And Love and Sex insisted on coming too, dressed in psychedelic colors and higher than kites, rainbow and rain. For a long time, I would hold, surrounded by the bandanas, braless T-shirts, and nippled signatures of our youth, those quiet vows created by home, church, and 4-H. Home was my loyalty to my parents in a farm. Church was loyalty to God, but 4-H, head, heart, hands, health for my club, my community, my country, that was an oath to the larger world. And these oaths would become a ragged and slowly disintegrating armor. They might have lasted a lifetime if not for those other two, Love and Sex, those vagabonds and vanguards to the breakings that had until that decade held me in place. If they couldn't be brazen, as they couldn't be in heart, they would be subtle in their purpose. Here were Sex and Love, dressed in church clothes, top collar starting to unbutton, utterly seductive, surreptitious as snakes. Except for the fierce familial love of my people, I had no authentic understanding of either of those lunatics, Love or Sex, but I had 4-H, and because of that, I knew this much. I knew how they would be dressed.
What a wonderful launch into this new narrative.
Thank you.
So what period is covered in the course of this book?
Covers the 10 years from 1959 to 69. And even though we were in this very isolated and protected small town, certain things really, really affected us. And one of those things was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I remember very distinctly.
So do I.
Wow. Yeah. And in the stories, I've tried to associate the historical moments as much as were relevant to the lessons in 4-H. So in this particular chapter, I am learning the secret hemstitch, which is a very critical moment for 4-Hers.
I don't quite understand.
I know
what
you
it
don't.
Is, but
you can tell by the expression on your face. But it is a really important little lesson that all 4-Hers learn, and I'm trying to learn this. And as it happens, I'm learning this during what becomes the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Okay.
I am learning the invisible hem. She tears it out. She says, it's got to be invisible. No one can see the stitches. I hold the thread, the needle, and concentrate while the news blares in the background. During the Texaco commercial, my parents get coffee. She finishes dishes. She calls my brothers in from raking leaves. Then Huntley Brinkley again. They are only half listening, moving through the little circles of chores. Change. When it comes, is first about stillness. The sound of the dishes stops. The voices from the TV shift in tone. Now, just the TV, just Huntley and Brinkley filling the air, a special report. My ever-moving mother and father stare at the TV, alert but without moving. Brinkley is talking about missiles, about the Soviet Union, a place called Cuba, a man named Castro, a dictator. My father gets up and paces. My mother rubs her forehead, says, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. This is what happens, he says, and I look at her face. I feel a strange buzz running through me. The next day at school, we hear all about the missiles that are aimed at our country from the island called Cuba, which is a communist country. It is not on our side, it is on Russia's side, or Russia is on its side. And Cuba is very close to our country, right by Florida. And in current events class, we learn that Kennedy wants Khrushchev, the leader of Russia, who is a communist, to take the missiles away. And Khrushchev says no. Khrushchev and Castro are friends. It's very confusing. Every night they watch the news, my parents. Every night I sit with the dress and try the secret hemstitch with stitches so small they will be invisible. I sit there so it looks like I am trying to do something useful, but my body buzzes and the stitches show. My father talks to his friends from the war. I overhear him say, we could have a third. And to my mother, we have to be ready. He touches her shoulder. She nods. When I get home from school the next day, my mother is in the basement. I walk down the rickety steps all the way to the musty back room with the stone walls. My mother is stacking gallon water jugs on the shelves. She has rolled the winter blankets up, and they are resting on the old bed Dad uses when he can't sleep in the heat. She is moving quickly. Is this a bomb shelter? I ask. Help me stack these. She hands me canned beans to shelve. Is there going to be a war? I place the cans on the shelf in a crooked line. Of course not. She picks up the broom to sweep the cracked cement floor. I feel the buzz turn to a racket in my ears. She sees my face. They are going to take care of this, she says. She throws the sacks of hard beans on the shelves with a loud thud.
Wow. Being in a bomb shelter with beans.
Beans. Yeah.
Perhaps a direct hit would be
more preferable. Yeah.
Oh, that was an interesting time, and you capture it so beautifully.
Oh, thank you.
So what's next? We have this new book coming out.
Mm-hmm.
You probably have lots of other writing projects that are waiting for you.
Well, yes, they've been kind of stacking up. I've been able to get some things done, as I mentioned earlier, but much of this is, well, you said it best when you said, if you do it right, this can be the most productive time of your life. I mean, I was so affirmed by your statement. And I think that that's the attitude I am going toward this time with that framework. And I want to do some more plays. Mm-hmm. I have outlines for 3 or 4 plays that have been sitting for a long time. I think I'd like to make maybe my last memoir, one about my father, who died in 2010. And then I'm also looking at essays again. I love the lyric essay. I love mm-hmm. the quiet. And you can see that running in my work. I love how the imagery has to carry almost more than action that you find in a lyric essay. And it just feels like now that I can kind of honor a more singular muse, it's just opening up, and I'm anxious and also excited to find out what's going to happen.
Well, you have so many friends in the area. Mm. We have all benefited so much. You have been a great mentor and friend and supporter of the arts and given unselfishly of your time. So I'm saying thank you for so many people.
Oh, Aaron, I have been given back in equal amounts on everything.
People are going to want to continue to follow you. I know that you are going to teach workshops. You are mm-hmm. going to do readings.
Yes.
And the best way of doing that is to go to your website.
That is right. All the independent teaching adventures I'm on are listed under coming events at www.annemarieohman.com.
Now, does it have the dash in it?
Yes. Yes, it does.
It's very important to remember that. Anne-Marie Ohman.
That's right. That's right. The little hyphen. Yes.
.com.
Yes. Thank you.
Well, I wish you well.
And thanks for having me. And Aaron, you know, I just so appreciate what you do with these interviews. You keep the literary culture alive and running by getting the word out. Thank you.
Thank you.